Hey gang, if you're in a band in Austin, I gotta tell you, man, it's summertime, it's too hot to practice in the garage. And you're bothering your neighbors, probably. And it's too hot to practice in the living room. You're bothering your family, your loved ones, your roommate, your parents, your wife, your husband, everyone. You're bothering everyone with this band thing. Let me tell you about a place where you can go and be left to your own devices in an air-conditioned room in a nice environment with a great PA. That's Space Rehearsal and Recording. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording, located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin with 31 spacious rooms with excellent PAs, ice-cold air conditioning, lots of people running around getting their shit together. You go there and get your shit together. You can find them at 512-448-9518 or go to spaceatx.com. Take the talent train from Schmoesville to Protown with Space Rehearsal and Recording. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Welcome to the show. If you're listening to this show the day it came out, why is it coming out on a Thursday instead of a Friday? Shows come out every Tuesday and every Friday, Johnny. Why is this one coming out on a Thursday? Well, because today is Thursday, August 10th, 2017. And that is 6 years to the day that episode one featuring Susanna Schoffel came out on August 10th, 2011. So 6 years we've been doing this show. I've been doing this show. I've been talking to people. They've been coming here. I've been going places. We've been having live shows. I keep putting them out two a week, every week, 52 weeks a year, 104 shows a year. Get into it, man. How did I get here? So I was thinking about this. I was like, man, it's been 6 years, and I didn't do like a best of show this year. But then I thought, like, how? Why don't I just go back and kind of find a few conversations that I really enjoyed and that I thought were cool? And I'll bring you pieces of them and let you check out a little bit of How Did I Get Here over the last 6 years. Celebrating 6 years of How Did I Get Here. This is episode 617. Welcome to the show. And thank you so much for listening. I love doing this show. I've talked about it many times, but I'm going to say it one more time. I'm really appreciative to you, the listener. I'm really appreciative to all the guests that take the time to come here and sit down and talk to me. I love talking to these people. I get something out of it. 6 years later, I still get something out of it. I love talking to all these people. All right, so without further ado, let's move into this show, all right? For the very first one, here's an artist I didn't even know. I got an email from a publicist. She was like, hey, I've got this artist coming to Austin. He's going to be playing at Emo's. Would you like to do a podcast with him before the show? And I'm like, sure. I look him up. His name's Frank Turner. Turns out he's huge. He's a guy from England. He's a lot bigger in Europe than he is here, but he's really big here. I mean, that show was sold out at Emo's. So it was very exciting. And I got to go meet him for his sound check or around his sound check time. And I sat down with him backstage. This is from episode 430 that came out on October 30th, 2015. This is me and Frank Turner sitting backstage where I ask Frank to tell me about the correlation between folk music and punk music in the ethos of the whole thing. Here's me and Frank Turner backstage at Emo's, episode 430, October 30th, 2015. The example I could think that crossed into a more singer-songwriter thing.
Yeah.
When you bring the punk ethos into that, and there's also like that same kind of thing in folk music.
Yeah, I mean, it's prefacing all this with the fact that I didn't do any of these kind of calculations when shifting one to the other. You know,
right.
it was an instinctive move. But like, yeah, I think that the punk and folk have a lot in common. Not least that they're two four-letter words that are argued about by people who need to get a hobby.
Right.
But I mean, I like the sort of iconoclasm of it, you know, and the sort of this communitarian aspects of it. I think are really interesting and important to me.
Yeah. How did you grow up? Did you grow up in the class? Which, you know, were you wealthier or
My parents are solidly middle class.
Yeah.
My upbringing was weird because I got an academic scholarship to a school for the rich, as it were, which means that it's sort of slightly short-circuited the British class system for me in a way. I hate the British class system. I hate talking about it. I hate being part of it. It's complete fucking bullshit judging people by what their parents do for a living.
Right.
And I don't think anyone should ever do that.
Right. So do you feel like that feeds that, like being the not rich kid in the rich kid school fed that sort of like punk rock, like,
Certainly. Well, I mean, as a teenager, because I mean, I went there when I was 13 years old, and which is it's sort of a time in life when you start figuring out some basic parameters about how the world works anyway. And it took me a little while to realize quite how ridiculous some of the kind of social mores of the place that I'd been imprisoned,
yeah,
as it were, you know, and I was very angry about when I sort of figured out. I mean, like the example I always think of is that like some of the kids at that school use the expression plebs to refer to anybody who isn't privately educated. I didn't really understand what that meant until I'd sort of thought about it for a bit. And then when I did figure out what it meant, I was filled with rage.
What does it
mean? Disgust. Well, plebeians.
Okay. Right. Okay.
And I just think it's disgusting. And that was around the time when I kind of stumbled across like the Clash and the Sex Pistols and then Black Flag. And I certainly think the kind of the rage and kind of defiance and rejectionism, if you like, of stuff like Black Flag was helped me square a circle. It felt like a life raft.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like rock and roll saved your life.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not sure they would have died otherwise.
No,
but it certainly gave me meaning and purpose and direction and hope.
Yeah. That's a great thing. How are you doing? How are you holding up through this tour? You guys, you've been hitting it hard, and you're doing like two shows a day. You're doing like record stores and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I've got two shows to come today. Yeah. But we had day off yesterday, so, you know, win some, lose some.
Yeah.
It's good. I mean, like, I've been touring for more than half of my life now, and I've been on the road probably more than I've been off it for the last 17 years. Well, no, definitely been on the road more than I've been off it for the last 17 years. And we had a bunch of time off at the end of last year, beginning of this year, to do with making a record, which I hated, and I'm very pleased to be back in my comfort zone.
You're a road dog.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm kind of slightly wary about applying terms like that to myself.
Okay.
Do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
This is the thing I'm good at in life. This is the method of existence I find kind of doable and comfortable.
Frank Turner, backstage at Emo's episode 430 that came out on October 30th, 2015. Go on back and listen to it, episode 430. It was a great conversation. We talked about all kinds of stuff. It wasn't a terribly long conversation because he had stuff to do, but we talked for about 40 minutes. It was great. Frank Turner, great artist. All right, next up is my dear friend, Kathy Valentine, from episode 18, recorded on October 22nd, 2011. Now, that was a long time ago. She had the Blue Bonnets. We had been playing together already for a while. At this point in 2017, Kathy and I have been playing off and on together when we can for the last decade, for the last 10 years. I started playing with her like 10 years ago. I love playing with her, love writing songs with her. She's been releasing singles. The latest one, The Place We Want to Be, a song that I got to co-write with her and I got to sing on with her, is available now. You can find her on Facebook, Kathy Valentine Official. That's her thing. Anyway, this is an interesting story because she's going to tell me the story in 2011 about when she joined the Go-Go's, all right? Now, before the Go-Go's quit playing, they fired Kathy, and that was a really sad move, I thought, on their part. And I've been friends with a few of them for a long time, and I'm very close with Kathy. I don't really see the other two a lot that I'm friends with. But it was a sweet story. When I went back and listened to it, I was like, oh, you know what? Let's play that. Let's talk about when Kathy met those girls and they started the Go-Go's. So this is Kathy Valentine from episode 18 from way back on October 22nd, 2011.
What a difference.
So were you in the Text Tones when you first
saw them?
When
I first saw them, yeah.
Did you guys do shows together?
No, we weren't really. The Text Tones were more in the kind of, we were in a different circle. We played a lot with like the Plimsolls and the No. But I remember I had a 21st birthday party and I remember Belinda was there and because some of the Blasters were at my party, and it was the first time I got in Rolling Stone because Robin Zander was there. And,
no way.
Yeah, it was this big, like, kind of, for me, it was like a big celeb fest.
Was it at a club? Or,
yeah, it was at a club.
Cool.
Yeah, so, and my manager, he set it all up. I don't know how he pulled it off. But it was a big deal, and it was really cool. And Belinda was there. But I didn't really know those girls at all.
Right.
I mean, when Charlotte approached me to see if I could fill in for their sick bass player, that was the first... Oh, actually, I take it back. Gina, one time, me and Carla were looking for a drummer for the Textones. And Gina, before she joined the Go-Go's, she came to meet us. And we thought she seemed too much like a hippie.
Oh.
Yeah, so we didn't even consider her, which is, like, really funny.
That is funny.
Because she went in to try out for the Go-Go's, and they, like, yeah, we'll take her. And they, yeah. like, totally give her a makeover.
So they cut her hair and, like...
Yeah, they cut her hair and ditched the overalls and the wire rim glasses.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, so when they came to you, Charlotte came to you?
Yeah, yeah. Because they knew who I was, and...
How did that go? What was it?
And
was
the reason they knew is because when the Runaways were in Austin, I made, besides making friends with Joan and another one of them, Vicky, right. I made friends with their roadie.
Right.
And when I got to L.A., he was working for the Go-Go's.
Okay.
So he, and he was one of the only people I knew. I knew him and some guys. There was this band called The Plugs, and they had played at Raoul's.
Yeah.
And they were El Paso guys, but lived in L.A. So anyway, the Go-Go's roadie, he suggested me.
And
Charlotte saw me one night and said, hey, we need you. If you can play the bass, can you play the bass? And I said, yeah, I can play the bass.
How do you play the bass?
No. But I figured I could.
Yeah. And you could?
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
Anyone can play the bass.
Yeah. That is my dear friend, Kathy Valentine, from way back on October 22nd, 2011, from episode 18. Go back and listen to it. It's a great one. She's been on since then with the Blue Bonnet. She was on a live one, and we are threatening to do one where we sit down and talk because she's writing a book. She's been working on a lot of different projects. She's been writing a lot of songs. She's been releasing singles. She just released a record with the Blue Bonnets. So she's been very, very busy. Get out there and check out Kathy Valentine. Okay? Do that. All right, next up. The legendary drummer Hunt Sales from, like, Tin Machine, Iggy Pop, Todd Rundgren, so many different things. Like, you know, Lust for Life, that drum's on there, that is Hunt Sales. So having a career so illustrious like that also has its dipping points, and that's what we got to pretty early on in the conversation. I had known Hunt for a long time. I met him in the early 2000s when I had a studio with my old band Gowdy. We opened a studio, and we opened it to the public, and I knew this guy, Dickie Lee Irwin. And Hunt Sales was producing his record, and they were looking for a smaller studio that they could go in and do the vocal overdubs, which is just the singing and stuff like that. We had a small studio. We had nice microphones. We had a nice setup. And so so Hunt and Dickie came out, and that part ended a little weird between me and Hunt. Dickie and I stayed friends for a long time. I haven't seen him in a long time. Anyway, so I reached out to Hunt when I started the show. I was like, hey, come on the show. So we sat outside. We talked for a little while. Things are mellow between us. And since this episode on, this was from episode 88 on July 24th, 2012, we've been totally cool. We see each other every few months, sit down and talk, give a bunch of hugs. I love him. I want to play with him at some point in my life. I love going to see him play. Hunt Sales, amazing drummer. So this is him talking about how he navigates a career where there's illustrious times and there's lean times. Hunt Sales from episode 88.
Day at the end of each show. So, yeah. But who would have thought?
Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, really, yeah.
The one thing that
I think of this guy like covering himself in peanut butter. I mean, seriously, yes. Like at the time that he was doing it, and you're like, how in the fuck is that guy going to be on American Idol in 2011 or something? You know what I mean?
The one thing I've seen, one thing that I, that something that I've, I guess I've seen, so it's shown me this is a fact that what that has in common with other people that I've seen in the music world, that just the fact of not giving up and staying around.
Yeah.
What there's a word for that by default or what when by, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I've seen that over and over, the people that don't give up and they stay and stay. Yeah. Now, there's some people you wish would give up.
Right.
But, and no matter how long they're around, it doesn't matter. But that right. seems to be a thread that runs through a lot of people I've seen where they just didn't give up and they just kept going and going and going.
Yeah.
So whatever that means.
Well, I feel that. I mean, you've had a career that's been of that ilk. Like, you know, there's one might say that maybe after you played with Todd Rundgren, after Iggy, then the 80s, I know you were probably working consistently and playing in different things, but then it wasn't such a big step until you when it did Tin Machine.
Well, in music, in rock and roll especially, and pop music especially, we're not talking about classical music musicians or jazz musicians. Let's let's talk rock and roll pop, yeah. Which the world that I come from. In that. To have a career in that, it's a very short career because you'll see bands, the drummer or whoever that was with whoever from the 60s, and maybe they had a hit record, they toured for several years, maybe they got one other record in the top 30, but basically it's a 2 to 4 year career for most musicians. So now then there's the side guys,
right?
And I'm somewhere in between to have a, I've been very cursed or been lucky to, I don't know. I guess they say if you do it once, you're lucky. And if you keep doing it over, then you're really lucky or something. I don't know.
To have a band.
Well, yeah. I mean, to go on, I've been at a lot of the time at the right place at the right time. There's a lot of luck involved. There's some skill involved. To go, it seems I've gone, I at a certain time, I went from project to project to project. I've been really blessed. Starting in the 60s, 69, working with Todd Rundgren, and then going on from there and working with Bob Ezrin, the producer,
right.
And working with Bob Welsh when we had a band called Paris, and then going on and working with Iggy. And then working with people like Bootsy Collins in the studio, and then going and working with David Bowie, and then in between.
Wait, you're blowing through this too fast.
I'm just over 40 years.
Yeah,
you know, it's
that is an incredible career.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a bunch of lean periods, and when things, you know, when they're. There hasn't been work. We were talking about that a moment ago.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, gone out and picked up a sledgehammer and knocked walls down or done whatever.
I painted houses with Dickie Lee.
Exactly.
Hang on, just time out. I got to turn this AC off.
Yeah.
Sorry. So you were saying the lean times. You're not scared to go out and knock a sledgehammer?
Yeah, I mean, basically, what am I suited for out? My work record out there.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking about this. I thought about this and then had to deal with this. Is that picking the music as a career? Or, you know, I mean, it seems I turned around one day and was getting paid for what I loved to do. And it was after a fact that I went, I may need some more skills. You know, at the age of 15, I'd been recording prior to that. I started recording in studios at about 10 years old.
How did you get into, like, how did you become a drummer? What was the impetus? What was the, I mean, did you make a career choice obviously before 10?
Yeah. I don't know if it was a career,
life choice.
Well, it was something I was interested in and something that's all I really cared about. And it was between the age of 6 and 7.
Open up your heart. Let's go together.
Legendary drummer Hunt Sales. Go back, look at his discography, man. It is insane. I'm so glad that we got to sit down and have that conversation, bury the hatchet. Now when I see him, we hang out all the time. Go back and listen to that. That is episode 88. It came out July 24th, 2012. Great conversation with Hunt Sales, legendary drummer. As you can see, I'm kind of taking the cream of the crop. I'm like, hey, look at this. I got to talk to all these really incredible artists and all these like people that have this very rich history in rock and roll, you know? Next guest, no different. Legendary frontman from the band Fishbone, Angelo Moore, and I got together for episode 261, which came out on April 4th, 2014. Now, let me give you a little bit of history behind this show, okay? It took place on the Saturday of South by Southwest of 2014, all right? Now, it was the Saturday of South by Southwest. I had had 4 podcasts before this that started at 9 in the morning. Okay, well, let me give you a preview of what happened the Friday of South by Southwest. I did 2 podcasts and I was on a panel at South by Southwest on Friday. Then I got in a car with my friend Kyle Crusham, drove to Houston, played a show at the Continental Club, 2 1.5-hour sets with Skyrocket at the Continental Club in Houston, got in the car, drove back after the show, slept about 2 hours, walked downtown to meet some bands at the Hilton, which is downtown. It's walkable distance from my house. But halfway there, it started raining on me. So I'd been rained on. I was half asleep. I got very caffeinated. I went to go see Angelo Moore. Angelo Moore and the New Step. That was the name of his band at the time. So I go there to see him, and I'm excited to see him. I'm excited to meet him. I'm excited to sit down with a dude that I had seen for years and loved for years. I've been a fan of theirs since their first EP. I love Fishbone. So I get to the show. I get there. There's a bar. I'm like, finally, man, I got to have a drink. So I have a drink. They play, have another drink, go meet him, have another drink, and then we start talking. It was a loud place that we were at, so this is a little bit loud. I had had a few drinks, but this is from episode 261, which took place on the Saturday of South by Southwest in 2014, but came out on April 4th, 2014. This is me and Angelo Moore. Let's get down.
Got even it all then, style, yeah.
So it was like 89. It was like the week after I saw I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, and you guys were Fly Guys theme music.
Right, okay. That's when Huggy Bear was walking out in his
Right. Yeah.
Yellow
with
pimp suit.
With the aquarium shoes.
Yeah.
And they all start falling apart, and you guys keep on playing.
Ah.
Okay. So I went, I was managed by Fitzshields.
Okay.
And so I was like, Fishbone's coming. I'm going to go to their sound check. And they're like, fine, come on in. So I went there and I tried to talk to you guys, but it did not happen. But I just wanted to be like, I love you. You know what I mean? So those are my 2 stories. But listen, there's a great show today.
Thank you.
And the crowd got 78% better when you took the stage, like as far as beauty goes.
Right on.
Yeah, that was an ugly ass crowd before you took the stage.
Dude, that show was fun.
Yeah, you did.
I broke a sweat.
Yeah, you did.
I broke a sweat, man, and wore a suit and tie all the way through it.
Like everything.
Hell yeah, I was in there. I had my suit, my business suit on.
You're always.
I have my suit and tie on because I'm in business.
When did you start playing theremin?
I started playing theremin like. When Fishbone did Chim Chim's Badass Revenge. Uh-huh. So I guess that's probably like about 10, maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. But when we were doing Chim Chim's Badass Revenge with Dallas Austin, that's when I discovered the theremin.
How did it come to you? Was that Clara Birch documentary? Or no?
Well, I saw that,
yeah.
But the way I discovered it, I was walking down this hallway in the studio that the Fishbone was recording in at the time.
Yeah.
I was in the basement walking down the hallway, and I walked past the theremin and it went whoop. I just heard something go whoop when I walked past
it.
Because it was somebody had left it on.
Yeah.
And then I walked back and put my hand, I looked at it and I put my hand close to it and it went, ooh, and I'm like, oh shit, and that was it. That was it. I was hooked in.
Is it hard to play? I've never even tried. I've been so scared to try and learn it.
Yeah, it's a little hard to play. Well, you can't
there's
move.
No, there's no.
You can't move your body
you
around.
See. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
so you got to feel what the notes are.
Yeah.
You know.
You like that?
Well,
you have a connection to it? Like it's an instrument you have a connection to, right?
Yeah, because you really got to focus when you're playing, yeah. You know, if you want to play in tune.
Yeah.
If you're playing in tune, and you really got to focus because you got to feel what in the space of the notes.
Yeah.
In between each note is a certain space that you got to move, you know.
Yeah.
The lower notes are a bigger space to move your hand.
Right.
And the higher notes are a smaller space that you move your hand. And, you know. So it's really a scientific instrument. I love it, man. Yeah.
Do you live in L.A.?
Yeah, I live in L.A.
Yeah. And you Glendale. Guys live in San Francisco?
San Francisco.
Is that right?
Berkeley.
Right. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
How do you like it there? How long have you been there? This time?
I grew up in L.A.
Legendary Fishbone frontman Angelo Moore and me talking at a very loud place after his show with the brand new Step during South by Southwest 2014. That was a great conversation. I was punch drunk and I had a few cocktails. It was great getting to sit down and talk to one of my idols, though, learning how he works that theremin. Yeah. How do you work that theremin, Mr. Angelo? All right, great conversation with Angelo Moore. Next up, a giant dog. Sabrina and Andrew from Sweet Spirit and a Giant Dog came over way back in 2014. This is from episode 330. It came out in November 27th, 2014. I sat down with Sabrina and Andrew, and we talked about a lot of stuff that was going on with them. But basically, she told me how they got together with Sweet Spirit, and they both did. And we sat here in the apartment talking about it, episode 330, from November 27th, 2014, Sabrina and Andrew from A Giant Dog and Sweet Spirit. So your record, Bone, is amazing. I love it. And At first, I set out to see Sweet Spirit. Now, are you both in that band, too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We started Sweet Spirit last January, or this past January. It's about to come up a year for Sweet Spirit. And he and I have been writing together for a really long time. We had a giant dog for about 8 years.
Eight?
Yeah, you do this every time.
Damn.
You do this every time I mention how old a giant
eight
dog
years.
Is. It's 8 years. So in dog years, you know. Getting old.
Is that 32?
Oh, man.
No,
it's
24.
64. But what are y'all measuring? I thought dog,
dog years
were seven.
4 years.
Seven years.
I'm thinking of presidency.
And I'm putting up six fingers,
dude,
too.
Dude, I'm
we're
sorry.
All,
but
yeah.
No, our presidential age, yes, it would be 32.
So if the dog, a presidential dog.
Yeah.
If a giant dog were president. Geez, that's a long time. How do you guys... what's the difference? Because I didn't hear Sweet Spirit. I found this article online that was written by somebody that was like a culmination of all the blogs, and it had like the 11
Oh, okay, that was written bands. By somebody with British Airways. And because London
oh,
is starting a direct flight
to Austin.
Austin, and they listed Sweet Spirit as one of the top 11 bands
I know.
To watch in Austin. And I started getting all these people congratulating me. I'm like, oh... Thank you so much for, you know, being really proud of me that British Airways finds us to be one of the top 11 bands in Austin.
No, it was, but it was culminated
through blogs.
Which
yes,
is good.
It was Side One, Track One. It was John Laird that nominated us and wrote about us.
So I didn't find any music, but I trusted the picture. It was so cool. Honestly, I was like, well, this has got to be cool.
That shot was Tim Griffin. Brooklyn Vegan.
Well, that's a great photographer because he captured that moment.
One of our very first shows. That was Hole in the Wall in January. When my other band, Bobby Jealousy, broke up, I didn't want to cancel the free week dates that we had. And I got some guys together really fast. I think we practiced four times in 1 week and then played that Hole in the Wall show and a Red 7 show, and that was the birth of Sweet Spirit.
Wow.
At the beginning of the year.
And so what's gonna go on with that?
Well, we had a residency at the Blackheart in July. Do you want to talk about... he doesn't want to talk about this. We had a residency at the Blackheart in July, and as a gift to us, they did a live recording, and they're going to release our live album, Sweet Spirit Live at the Blackheart. That'll be out first next year. The next thing that will be out is an EP that Mike McCarthy, of course, recorded in one day.
Yes.
As kind of just for fun, and then we decided we'd better use it because use what you've got, you know.
Was that a Sweet Spirit?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then our third release will be an LP that Sweet Spirit's recording next week with Mike. We all took a week off work, and we're going to spend it with him.
Man, what a great thing.
Yeah.
You guys...
We've got a bunch of ideas.
You do?
Bring in a lot of auxiliary musicians.
And oh, really?
Strings and horns.
I noticed there was some horns on the A Giant Dog.
And yeah. And A Giant Dog's third LP will have more of that, more horns, more strings.
I love it, man. And you guys are able to, like, even, like, bring it, you know, there's a dynamic in the band. It's not just all, like, you know, energy and what's the fuck you song.
Oh.
Stuff like that. You know what I mean? That you can bring it. There's
it's, nature.
You move. You have dynamics.
Thank
there you
God.
Go. God, that was fun. It's interesting to listen to that because Andrew and Sabrina, that record that they were going to do, that they all took off a week of work the next week that they were going in to record with Mike McCarthy, was Sweet Spirit's album Kokomo, which is an awesome, awesome album. I love that album. I love A Giant Dog. I love anything that Sabrina and Andrew do. They're great artists, great musicians. I love A Giant Dog, but I'm a huge, huge Sweet Spirit fan. That's how I became aware of the great director John Valley, who was on my show. He was on the show a year ago or so. Great video director. Go out there. Check out these videos. Check out Sweet Spirit. Check out A Giant Dog. Check out all these artists that I'm talking to. These are all fantastic. And A Giant Dog and Sweet Spirit, they are based in Austin. So is Kathy Valentine. So is Hunt Sales. Angelo and Frank are not. And neither is my next guest, Bruce Sudano, who you may not know. You might be like, who's Bruce Sudano? Well, he was married to Donna Summer from the 70s up until she passed away a few years ago. And he came out with a solo album, I believe it was last year. Yeah, it was last year. And he came by when he was here during South by Southwest, and we sat down and had an amazing conversation. Now, this guy is absolutely fantastic. He co-wrote some of those biggest hits for Donna Summer, Bad Girls, songs like that. And in this part of the conversation, we're talking about what happened in 1980 when the disco boom was over and he was putting out a solo album. What was going on? Oh, they put up a wall to Mr. Bruce Sudano, but don't worry about it. He stayed creative. He's still releasing amazing music. Get out there and check him out. He's amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing. This is from episode 477, which took place during South by Southwest of 2016, but came out on April 1st, 2016. This is me and the amazing Bruce Sudano chatting it up during South by Southwest.
I'm on a different row doing a different thing than I've ever done before, because I've done a lot of things, but I've never been the solo artist going out there and just being me, you know. So I've
not
always,
even like in the early 80s when you did it?
No, because in the early 80s, what happened was I was in Brooklyn Dreams up until 1980.
Right.
Then I recorded a solo record as me, and at the same year I got married, my wife got pregnant. And it was kind of like a false start because I immediately shut down the solo Bruce Sudano because there was no way I could maintain my family, my relationship, my wife having her career, yeah. and me trying to be a solo guy at the same time. So right. I just got, you know, I continued writing and producing and doing stuff like that. But this guy never got to, you know, be the guy that I am now, you know.
Yeah.
So. So, yeah.
That's interesting. And, when you talk about that time, there's when I guess the end of Brooklyn Dreams, the music shift was going against so much you know what I mean? Like the disco sucks phase started like swinging that way.
Yeah.
And then you wrote a great song for Dolly Parton that ended up on the top of the country charts.
Yeah.
Genius, well, by the way. I know it probably wasn't planned, but genius.
Definitely wasn't planned. It's all an accident. You know, I mean, most things are accidental. You know, the thing is, you do what you do, you stay in the game, and you keep walking down the road, and you see what happens, you know. So, you know, first and foremost, Brooklyn Dreams was never meant to be a disco band. You know, we were an R&B driven.
Yeah, I was listening to some of the songs, you know, like some deep funk.
Yeah, and so we got, you know, because of what was going on in the moment.
Of course.
You know, so the first Brooklyn Dreams record, you know, I was always trying to do hybrids of things. So, you know, I grew up as a kid who was inspired by the Brill Building songwriters.
Yeah.
And, you know, my main band was early Rolling Stones. I mean, so like when I put bands together, I mean, that's kind of the elements that was driving me. And so Brooklyn Dreams just came into a time when disco was exploding, and our record deal got sold to Casablanca Records, and the first thing that they said to us is, you guys got to do this.
Right.
You know, and but, you know, I mean, I was always trying to do hybrid. So, like, there's a song on the first, you know, Brooklyn Dreams album called Street Dance, you know. So it was an element of funk, an element of rock, and an element of R&B. And so I would always try and incorporate it in, you know, I loved R&B music. But lyrically, R&B music always left me a little. It was always, you know, other than Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye and Stevie, you know, it was a little, always became cliched, you know. Yeah. So I was always more attracted to, you know, on their lyrical side of a Jackson Brown and all that. And so I was always kind of trying to a hybrid stuff. And subsequently, what happens is when you do that is that people never know what category to put you in.
Right.
You know, so you're not quite R&B, you're not quite pop, you're not quite this. So it's not necessarily a good thing to do. But no. So that's why even what I'm doing now is like, it's like Cindy, my manager, is kind of like encouraging me to streamline it down to even more of just me and Randy, because even in what we do now, there's jazz elements and rock elements. And
well, that's what I like, is that there's a minor seventh and major seventh thing you're not scared to do in that G, C, D world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. I can't help myself.
Of course not.
So,
You know the language. Why deny the knowledge?
Yeah. Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
The amazing Bruce Sudano. He is out there. He's out there playing. I just saw him on Instagram. He even liked one of my pictures on Instagram. What a flattering thing. He's out there playing shows, man. If you know him or want to know him, get out there and find him. Bruce Sudano, amazing artist. Amazing. All right. Next up, this was a real treat. I got to talk to director Penelope Spheeris and her daughter Anna Fox. Penelope Spheeris directed Wayne's World. She directed the Beverly Hillbillies movie. She directed, I think, either Black Sheep or Tommy Boy, one of those two movies. And she also, in the 80s, made this series of documentaries called The Decline of Western Civilization. Most popular of those was Part 2. It was a trilogy. And Part 2 is The Metal Years. And in the metal years, there's a lot of crazy stuff. Ozzy's on there. The guy from Wasp, you know, drinking in the pool with his mom watching. One of the most famous scenes of the movie. But anyway, she re-released the movies in 2015. Shout Factory Records put the movies out on, cleaned them up and put them out on DVD and Blu-ray. And I picked them up before I even got to do this interview. And then I got, they reached out from the Austin Film Society and asked me if I wanted to interview her via Skype, which I did, and then I went to the showing of Part 3, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 3, which is a punk movie and a sad movie. And anyway, got to meet her, got to meet Anna, and it was fantastic getting to talk to Penelope. Now, the thing that I asked her about was my favorite part of the whole movie. When Paul Stanley from Kiss is interviewed, the camera is above him. He's laying in a bed with three girls that are dressed in lingerie. And I thought that's how a guy like that wakes up, but Penelope Spheeris set me straight. This is Penelope Spheeris and her daughter, Anna Fox, from episode 407, which came out August 21st, 2015. Let's get down. So what all did you do to the movies? Like, you cleaned them up, or...
Well, yeah, we did 2K restoration on the original negatives, and that was mostly a part I sat in on, because I'm real particular about the timing and the look of it all. And then, and Anna is the one that she was there for a lot of the timing and everything, but also she's the one that worked on the extras, because I honestly couldn't handle it.
Right. Well, the extras are great, and it actually answered one of my questions about Decline 2, but can I, on behalf of my other musician friends, I'm a musician as well, that came up watching that movie, the scene...
It's either got to be the orange juice or the vodka.
No. That, I do have a question about that, but I think that one's pretty self-explanatory. What I want to talk about is Paul Stanley, because... when you first see that movie, before you're really in the business, you're like, wow, that guy wakes up with three girls in a bed. And that's how he conducts an interview. But then as you get older and you start figuring out who you are as a person, and you yourself are an artist and you do interviews, you're like, whose idea was that? Like, I saw in the extras that obviously they were there when you showed up, right? The ladies?
Oh, when I showed up?
Yeah.
No, what happened was when Paul showed up, we had the camera all set up, and I had the girls already there.
Oh, okay.
And then he took me aside. I remember he took me into this bedroom and said, we sat on the bed, and he goes, Penelope, those girls are not good-looking enough that you have here. Yeah. So I said, well, I don't have any more girls, you know? And he goes, hold on a minute. And he calls the Playboy Mansion. So we had to wait until the girls came down. Yeah.
That is amazing. He's an interesting cat. He's a very quotable guy. He knows how to speak in quotes.
Well, yes, he does. And here's the thing. I'm really glad that Anna put all these, strung all the entire interviews together. Because that's the extras for Decline 2, because it's actually being more fair to Paul. I think I was not fair to Paul when I cut the movie. I think I grabbed little pieces, and, you know, he said that he was trying to be funny during the whole thing, but it didn't turn, you know, you weren't laughing with him. You might have been laughing at him in the
exactly.
movie, but if you watch the extras, then you're laughing with him.
Yeah. Yeah, you're
really
in on the joke.
It really is more fair to Paul, because he's a good dude, and he's really smart, and he's really cool, and I'm glad that now people can see it right.
That's good. Don't want to find out. Just want to get out. Yeah, Penelope Spheeris setting the record straight about the Paul Stanley part of Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, The Metal Years. Get out there. Man, check out these videos. They are amazing. I bet you can get them on Amazon or iTunes, and you can definitely find them in record stores, because they're specialty things. I bought the box set. I did. Yes, I did. Love those movies. And I love The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, The Metal Years. Everybody does. Everybody that sees it loves that movie. It's weird. It's creepy. It's odd. There's a lot of weird characters in there. And she really does approach them with an open heart and a lot of love. Penelope Spheeris and her daughter Anna Fox from episode 407, which came out August 21st, 2015. Great, great, great conversation. All right, next up is my friend David Grissom. He was on episode 89 on July 27th, 2012. Now, David Grissom is an amazing guitar player that's played with many different people, from the Allman Brothers to John Cougar Mellencamp to all kinds of people. He played with the Dixie Chicks. He was a guitar player in the Dixie Chicks band at the height of their thing. In 2003, when the Iraq War broke out, he was on stage with them overseas when Natalie Maines made her famous comment that she didn't like the president, or whatever it was that she said, and she's from Texas. And then that got out in the news, and it got crazy. Well, when David was in here back in 2012, I had him tell me the story, because I find it fascinating. I find that story fascinating, to hear someone that was on the inside, saw it happen, and then saw the aftermath of the hatred that came after the Dixie Chicks for no reason, for just a few words said on stage, mistaken. This is David Grissom from episode 89, July 27th, 2012. Let's get down.
I did two Dixie Chicks tours, 2003 and 2006, and then we went out.
Oh, you did the 2003 one. That's like the one that they made the movie about and stuff.
The first gig, the first gig I did with them was Saturday Night Live, but the first real gig we did was the gig.
In London.
In London.
She said it.
Yeah. We were on stage.
Did you, like, when it happened?
Absolutely, I did. The irony of it is, you know, I thought back on it later. As we walked down the steps at Shepherd's Bush Empire, I saw, you know, they have those sheets, you know, support act, what time, dinner, what time's dinner, this, that, and the other. And then it said Clear Channel at the bottom. And I just remembered seeing that. And, you know, Clear Channel at the time was sort of widely vilified for homogenizing the record.
Radio industry, the radio landscape
in this country. But, you know, in the band, we had a couple of the bluegrass guys were mm-hmm. really conservative.
Right.
And then we had a couple of guys that are super liberal and, you know, other people that were sort of in the middle. I mean, it was a nice cross-section. We all got along and had really nice, fun
I can't even remember what it was that talk. She said, but I watched that movie.
Well, we were in England for a week. We did the only rehearsals we did, you know, in London.
Right.
And so we were staying in a hotel right on Hyde Park, and there were huge demonstrations every day that came by our hotel, anti-war demonstrations.
Right.
And we had not invaded Iraq yet.
Right, right.
So...
But it was that time of freedom fries and, like, such insane patriotism.
Yeah, I guess, but I don't know if it had really even gotten that far yet.
Right.
You know, it was all talk at that point.
Right, right.
And so we're playing the gig, and I remember her telling me before the gig that, you know, God, the last few times we played here, it was nothing but expats from Texas that had come out. So she, in the gig, she said, how many people here are from Texas? And like one person raised their hand. And she goes, that's incredible. Because nice to know that we're finally getting, you know, a London, you know, some fans here in London. And then just flippantly said, just so you know, we're ashamed the president's from Texas. And yeah. I mean, I stopped in my tracks. I was like, oh boy. I mean, I don't know why it registered. I mean, I didn't want him to invade Iraq. I mean, that was my personal opinion at the time.
Right.
But it was like, we're not going to hear the end of that. And after the show, I actually said something to the guys in the band. I said, did you happen to hear that? And the guys that were really conservative, like, oh, yeah, no big deal. And I said, I'm going to bet that's not the last we hear of it. And we went from England over to Australia. And then, like, you know, so I'm out of the country for another month. And I'm talking to Shelley on the phone. And she's like, there's some really weird stuff starting to go on over here.
Yeah.
They're like burning records.
Yeah.
They're not playing them on the radio. I mean, yeah. And I'm like, you're kidding me. You know, it can't be that bad. Well, by the time we got back, we had to move where we rehearsed our tour. Like the big production in LA,
yeah,
we had bomb-sniffing dogs every single day of that entire tour that came into our dressing room. Wow. We had security, you know, it was like the guys with the earpieces everywhere we went. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's
just so funny you can say something and just the timing of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can just really change everything.
It changed everything.
It changed everything for them. I mean,
it did. It changed everything for them. And you know, it went on and on and on.
It did.
And, you know.
So then what was the next tour like after that?
The next tour. A few years later, right?
Yeah,
3 years later. That tour, they had already sold the tickets and it was sold out. And it was much, it was still, you know, they managed to, it was, their fans can't really, you know, there would be a pocket of booze every now and then, and now they would say, bring it on, let's have it.
I liked that about her, the way that she handled it.
And the rest of the crowd would drown out the people that were booing and everything, and we'd go on, and it was a real lighthearted show, and it would, but about 3 years later, man, it was just, you could tell it had taken its toll, and the show was way different. It was just like, you know, it went from this real lighthearted thing to this sort of stoic, much more reserved performance, and it didn't sell in the States, like, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, we played in Vancouver, sold out two nights, 17,000 people. The next night, drive down to Seattle, and there's 9,000 people there. It's an hour and a half down the road.
Wow,
you know,
yeah.
But you just
so weird. It's like just, the it's like the we're bigger than Jesus thing. I mean, it really was.
Yeah. I have so many mixed feelings about the whole experience. It was just a lot. I mean, I saw, you know, there's just a lot on both sides of the aisle that were disheartening.
Yeah.
How the politics got so ramped up and just, you know, like, can we all just move on?
Yeah.
You know, really, really... Can we just move on?
Yeah. Stay until your love is alive and kicking. Even though that conversation took place while our last president was still in his first term in July of 2012, before he was reelected for a second term, that sentiment, can we all just move on, applies now. David Grissom, what an amazing musician, what an amazing dude. I've always loved that guy. I love seeing him. I love hearing him play. He's got such a distinct voice. Go back and listen to that episode. Episode 89 came out in July 27th of 2012. Great conversation with David Grissom. Next up, one of my favorite dudes that I've met over the last few years and that I really kind of got to know through the podcast. This is from episode 314 that came out October 6th, 2014. This is percussionist John Bush, who you might know, who is the percussionist for Meaty Bukel and the New Bohemians. He also does his own show here on Sundays in Austin. He has been doing it. I don't know if he's still doing it. Over at 1-to-1 Bar, he does a show at like 5:30 in the afternoon. Amazing. I've been his special guest there before. And I really like John. He's an amazing guy. My friend Kyle just produced the latest Edie Raquel and the New Bohemians album, which comes out, I don't know when, maybe in the next few months or something. I'll let you guys know. I'm excited to talk about it. I'm trying to get Kenny Withrow on here. I'm trying to get John Bush back on here. Maybe the Golden Goose, Edie Raquel, even though she doesn't like to do the interviews. That's what I heard. Anyway, John Bush and I had a great conversation. He told me the story of how he got to know Edie Raquel and got in the band. So this is from episode 314. Took place October 6th, 2014. My man, John Bush. Hey, hey, hey. All right, go ahead. No, I don't want to interrupt you. There's no like Crimson here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
No,
yeah.
No one's like, you don't go to Charlie Sexton's house and listen to the Court of the Crimson King. Right, although you exactly. might. I'm
right,
not
right,
off,
right.
So.
But so, you know, we really... you know, that was a lot of our, you know, thing, you know, long jams and so on and so forth. And then when jam bands became a thing and I was watching a jam band and it was so noodly and I was like, it made me scared to improvise anymore. Like, oh my God, I hope we're not so
annoying
noodly.
Anyone.
Right, right. And I knew we probably were, but a lot of those guys are just heavy hitters though. You know, like you say, the Earl Harvins, the Kenny Withrow.
I can't even
think
of. We
know
of,
so many people that were like that.
Mike Dillon. I mean,
Mike
everyone.
Dillon. Right. So, you know, when Edie was going to the Arts Magnet the same time I was, and she was an art major, and she was very shy, and we both kind of were, and actually our first conversation we ever had, besides maybe saying hi to each other in the hall, she was working at Sound Warehouse, another record store back in the day.
And everybody worked there, like the San Paulos, like there's a whole,
yeah.
The Dallas music scene is awesome. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, and I was in there on a Talking Heads t-shirt one day. She's like, I like your t-shirt. Thanks. Don't you go to my high school? Yeah. But anyway, so once she got into, she'd already like wanted to sing, you know, written lyrics and stuff. And so then after high school, and then Brandon Ailey, drummer from New Bohemians. Right. He went to the Arts the year after I'd left. Anyway, that was the connection why Edie first set in with the New Bohemians, when it was Brad Houser, Brandon Ailey, and this other guy named Eric Presswood. And then Kenny came in the band, and Eric went on to do other stuff. And then shortly after that, I joined the band. But anyway, but Edie was such a great thing for us because, you know, we had a hard time knowing how to focus our ideas or to consolidate things or to write concise songs, you know? I mean, we were in rock bands and some, you know, sometimes wrote concise music, you know, but for the most part, we like to stretch out and stuff. So it was great having that combination of someone, especially, you know, her being so new and fresh to music. It wasn't already set like in certain ways or formulas or things, you know.
I've never heard it like that. That's a really good way to say it.
Yeah, she's so creative, and even to this day, and she's so quick-witted and can improvise lyrics and put together cohesive thoughts on the spot, that then our improv stuff was still there with her making up songs and lyrics on the spot too. So we would do a lot of that at shows besides, you know, playing the songs we would write and so on and so forth.
And where were you guys? Was it Dada where you guys were doing your... Was that like a weekly thing? Did you have a weekly thing?
Well, we didn't really have a weekly thing. Man, believe it or not, we would play like from 85, 86, 87, we would play 15 gigs a month in Dallas, Denton, Fort Worth. I mean, wow. It's amazing how often we played. And after, you know, some of the shows would be lean, but after a while, even before we got signed, there was almost good crowds every time, no matter what, you know? Yeah. And it was amazing that we were able to play that much, you know, and still have people come see us. But of course, you're in your 20s, you know, 50 or 100 people in your 20s.
It's easier to have a conversation with a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot easier than when you get in your 30s, 40s, 50s, yeah. You know? So,
that's why, like, your gig at 1 to 1 starts like at a reasonable time. Like,
exactly. I gotta get home.
5:30. I can still make it home in time for dinner.
Oh my gosh! The first one we did of that, I was really nervous, and I drank, you know, kind of more than I probably would have. And I came out of the club, and the sun was still out. And it's like, holy cow, I'm drunk enough to where it's like 3 or 4 in the morning. I'm going to have to go. Someone needs to drive me somewhere. I can drive. The sun's still out, for crying out loud.
That's awesome. So who were the other bands in that scene at that time, like the 85 to when you guys got signed?
In 85, this band in Dallas called Feet First, which was Feet First and New Bohemians both came out of being ska bands.
Oh, yeah.
And then morphed into pop, rock and roll,
right,
neo-psychedelic stuff. They were, you know, also very influenced, you know, very kind of XTC-ish, you know?
Yeah.
So there's those guys. And then a lot of the other mainstays in Dallas at the time were like this band End Over End and Shallow Rain and Three on a Hill and...
I think Three on a Hill was like on their way out when I was starting to play.
Oh, well, huh?
Going up there.
Where did you grow up?
Well, I mean, I lived here when I was a teenager until I started my junior year in high school, and my mom died. I moved to Miami.
Oh, wow.
And then lived in Houston for a while and played. And that's, I met, like, I did shows with Ten Hands and stuff there, and mm-hmm. we were managed by that club, Fitzgerald's.
Oh, cool,
and
yeah.
So I got to, we actually did a lot of shows with Ten Hands. That's how I saw Mike and then Buff.
Yeah, and then Ten Hands came along.
Oh, yeah.
Shortly after all that.
I totally everybody's seen him naked because of all the, I remember walking into the Axiom one time and seeing him swinging from the rafters completely naked. I've seen his taint. sorry. So, no. The amazing John Bush. I love that dude, man. And listen, we can't celebrate 6 years of How Did I Get Here without bringing up the word taint. So I want to thank John for coming by. I need to have him back in here. I need to do it when the New Bohemians record comes out. See how many of those guys I can wrangle into this here podcast studio and talk to these dudes. All right? Great conversation with John Bush. All right, man, we're coming to the end of this of this, I guess, greatest hits or some hits or, hey, these are conversations that have happened. I'm going to take you to one of the weirdest moments of all of How Did I Get Here. It took place just a couple of months ago at our 600th episode live podcast recording. One of my very best friends, AJ Vallejo, came on stage and really wanted to talk about one thing, and that was it. He didn't want to talk about his band, didn't want to talk about his music. He wanted to talk about one thing. On the dais was Jamie Harris, Jane Ellen Bryant, and Nakia. Nakia's used to AJ's hijinks. In fact, for the last like 5 years, I've been having both of those guys on, or for the last 4 years, I've been having those guys on a live show once a year together because I love their vibe together. They're hilarious. They're funny. I love them both. And Jane and Jamie are two new friends of mine that I've met over the last year. Good friends. They become good friends very fast, but they were not ready for AJ and his onslaught of insanity when he came up on stage and started talking. So for the very last and the 10th highlight on this highlight reel, celebrating 6 years of How Did I Get Here, is from episode 600 with Nakia, Jane Ellen Bryant, and Jamie Harris. This is AJ Vallejo wanting to talk about just one thing. I like to have AJ on the show because he keeps me in check just when I think my head's too big.
I mean, okay, real quick. I this is...
What?
Because I'm up here. I mean, okay. I've done a few of these. Can we talk about... Can we talk about queefing?
I wanted to start with some career stuff.
Nobody gives a shit about that.
This
Nobody
is cares about his career. This, his whole career,
I mean,
is a
come
queef.
Come on, no, I've won...
Am I red?
You're always red, dude.
Dude, come on. I mean, what? You're going to say, oh, AJ's won some more awards. He's making some more fucking albums. Nobody gives a shit about that. Let's talk about queefing.
Okay.
All right.
Let's... Oh! Okay, because then I can finally talk to you about squirting.
Oh, my God.
What? Welcome happened? To the show. What? You know, I got a text message from Elizabeth. Sorry, I'm sorry. If anyone here is not prepared for it, we're guys in a band.
No, there was a sign on the door that said, when you enter, squirting.
Yeah, I just realized, like, oh, maybe some people don't know exactly. Some stuff's going to get talked about. Anyway, I had to take something out about something dirty. Go ahead.
I was typing Queen. I was looking up Queen videos because I was, you know, digging on Freddie Mercury and stuff. And I accidentally hit F instead of N.
Are you sure this wasn't a David Boyle story?
No, this is the truth. And it said, I'm getting old, you know, as you get older, you can't really see, like, I had, like, the fucking eagle eyes about 3 years ago, and now I have to wear these damn 1.5s you buy at Walmart for, like, $2. You know, like, I can't see shit anymore. Like... And I hit, and it said queef, and all these videos came up. Not like two million.
I'm sure. Do you think it's a fetish? Do you guys think it's a fetish?
I don't know like what it is, but it's apparently like popular. Like, and I'm talking about like young girls on the floor rolling around making these sounds.
Yeah.
That I didn't know. I just thought.
Rule 34, dude.
I mean, we've all had sex, and there's that awkward moment when you kind of turn her around, and you know, and she laughs, you know. You know, right? Yeah,
look at these poor people, their face. They weren't expecting this.
But anyway.
Look, Jane Ellen Bryant.
But I didn't know that it was like
I feel like the Waco and me is showing.
I didn't know it was like a sport. Like, these girls like.
I didn't realize it was a sport either.
There's girls. There's videos of these girls like. They're like slumber parties where they just like. Like, see who can queef the most and like within a minute.
Is that a kind of person? Do you notice that like maybe they're like. You know, like they're they might have a certain hairstyle or dress a certain way.
They're probably just
so we'll know who these people are. Because you guys obviously don't have these kind of slumber parties.
Or do you?
Or that was the creepiest sound. Yeah. Or do you?
Yeah.
Or do you?
Welcome to episode 600.
I think it was the great Dr. Hunter S. Thompson who said, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. That was by far the weirdest moment on the last 6 years of How Did I Get Here. And you know what? I had a great laugh. I think that Jane and Jamie were taken by surprise, but everybody had a good time. And AJ is an agent of chaos. That's why I invite him on the show, because those kind of things are going to happen. Everyone's going to laugh. I'm here for entertainment. If it offends a little bit, I understand, and I'm sorry. But I like entertainment. That's why I like doing this podcast. I've had a great 6 years doing this. A great 6 years. And I want to thank all of you that listen to the show. I want you to know, look, all these podcasts are available. They're all available. You go to the howdidigethere.podbean.com. Look on the right-hand column, and they're all there by month and year. Just click on the month and year. Look at the podcast. See what's going on. Start at the beginning if you want. Start in the middle. Look for names you might know. Look for names you never heard of. That's one thing about it is, you know, you might not know who Bruce Sudano is, but, oh, he's the guy that co-wrote Bad Girls, and he was married to Donna Summer, and he's had this illustrious career writing these songs for, like, Kenny Rogers and stuff like that. What's going on? I don't know Hunt Sales. Oh, he's only the son of Soupy Sales, was the drummer on Lust for Life, the drummer in David Bowie's band Tin Machine, the drummer on Todd Rundgren Runt. Angelo Moore, never heard that name, just the singer of Fishbone. Anyway, you know what I'm trying to tell you. Great, great guests on this show. I've really had a great time doing this show, and I will continue to do it. And I hope you enjoyed episode 617, celebrating 6 years of How Did I Get Here, some highlights, and as AJ left us with, some lowlights. So that's going to happen, you know, some lowlights. Anyway, I'm just kidding. AJ Vallejo brings a great, great, great life to this show, and I always enjoy his presence. That was a great live podcast, episode 600. Go back and listen to it. It was from June 13th, 2017. All right, thank you guys so much for listening to the show. Subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on Stitcher, subscribe on TuneIn, any podcast medium that you listen to. Like it, follow us on Facebook, like our Facebook page. See pictures of me and all the guests. Find out when new episodes come out every Tuesday, every Friday, except for, of course, this episode, which came out on Thursday, 6 years to the day that we released episode one. Thanks for listening. I mean, seriously, thank you for listening. I wouldn't do it if it wasn't for you. Let's get down.